Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And today's guest is Jackie, the Joke Man Martling. You know, one of the things that fueled my ambition as a kid growing up in New York was listening to today's guest and the rest of the gang on the Howard Stern radio show. I used to listen to them every morning, then record the show when I went into school or to work and listen to it late at night. I mean, these are guys who, they felt like outcasts, which is the way I felt. But they were determined, which again is the way I felt too. I was determined to do something with my life. And these guys said they wanted to beat the most popular broadcasters in New York, and I watched them do it. They said they wanted to crush the top guy in Philadelphia, and they did it. I remember them going out to Philly to hold a funeral for the guy they beat in the ratings. It was huge. Then they said they wanted to take their local radio show international or national, and then they went to Cleveland, Los Angeles, and even Canada. They took it international. That raw drive, the watching them grow, just motivated me. The climb inspired me. Well, my goal for this interview is to learn from an inside guy about how it happened. Since you, the person who's listening to me, is probably a content creator. I feel like we're all content creators today. And you're definitely ambitious, or else you wouldn't be listening to me. Let's both learn together from a guy who made it to the top. Jackie was the head writer of the Howard Stern Show and one of the on-air personalities, the guy in the room. He publishes his jokes today on jokeland.com. If you love offensive jokes the way I do, check out his Twitter account where he publishes a joke every day at 4:20. His Twitter account is at Jackie Martling. And I should say before I welcome him that this interview is sponsored by TopTal. If you need a developer to build your site, you have to go to TopTal. That's TopTal, like talent, T-O-P-T-A-L. I had dinner at my house. Two great people were there, great developers, apparently both rejected by TopTal previously in their careers. It was incredible. That's how discriminating TopTal is. If you need the top guys, go to them and they'll help you get them. TopTal.com. Jackie, welcome.
I'm sorry, I got to take a break here. I got to call TopTal.
You should call TopTal. They're fantastic.
Before going any further, I want to tell you how I love the name of your company.
Mixergy.
So simple, so wonderful. I just wanted to start with a compliment because the first time I saw that, I was like, this works. This
All
works.
All right, I dig that.
Of course, there's no indication what it is. But that's the beauty.
It gave me some flexibility to figure out what it was going to be. You know what I did when you first came on camera before we started? I started looking around. Right now we're seeing, I guess, your kitchen. Or no, it's not your kitchen. It's your dining area. Before I was looking at the living room, I said, did this guy really make it? Let me ask you right out. Did you become a millionaire from being on that show?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
I did.
And then you lost it?
I was smart. I paid off all my houses. I made no money to start. If you were a listener of the show, you know that I fought and fought, walked out three or four times, and came back fighting to get my salary up. And, of course, the last historical time, they did not meet my demands, and we didn't negotiate to a settlement. So
what did they offer you? Nobody ever talked about it. What's the amount that they offered you? Let's be open today.
My deal, in my mind, I was shot, Andrew. I was shot. My marriage, there was no way to end my marriage because after working 5 days and then going to, Las Vegas for the weekend, then working five more days, and then I have a free weekend. I wouldn't spend my weekend looking for a bachelor pad so I could cook on a hot plate and be making $1 million a year. I love my ex-wife is two doors away and she's dear to me.
You're saying your marriage was in trouble, you were staying up late, you were running yourself tired by waking up early. I get all that, but what did you ask for? What was the amount that they offered you?
The main thing of this story is everybody thinks I'm an idiot. So I want to give some background because I was totally fried. I couldn't make myself come home and take a nap, which is the irony of that now is I'm 67 years old, and all I want to do is take a nap. When I wake up in the morning, the only thing I'm thinking about is when can I lie down? But back then, I'd come home dreary-eyed. I'd work on the computer. Me and Nancy would watch Law & Order. We'd watch ER, and then they'd tease the news. I'd get to bed at 11:30 or 12 o'clock, up at 4:20. By Wednesday, I wanted to kill somebody. So I was really fried. And I was a little, there was a different things pulling at me. I knew I could never quit drinking if I was on the show. I wasn't sure how bad my problem was or wasn't, but there were a lot of intermingling the factors, and they put another writer next to me, and there was just some icky stuff in my life, and I couldn't break the logjam. And I said, you know what, I'm going to ask for a certain amount of money. And in my mind, I knew it was a five-year deal. In my mind, I wanted to make $1 million a year on average.
Okay.
When I left, I was making $580, and I wanted to make, and we were print, not we, they were printing money. Forget it. It was crazy how much money was coming in. I think I was making like $580 plus what I think the e-channel was giving me, like $50,000 or something.
Okay.
And listen, right now I'd kill for $50,000 or something. You know? And I don't mean to sound good.
Because they would also they would cut up the show and show video of it on E in half hour segments. So that was another $50. And what were you at? You were asking for $1 million. What did they offer you?
Well, I wanted $1 million. On the average, so what I wanted was 809, $1 million, $1 million, $1 million, $1 million, $2 million. That's okay. What we were going to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
So my lawyer started at $1 million a year. I was making like 578, and the first thing they offered me was I think 615 or something, whatever 7%. Sales raises, which is just like, you know, we're the number one radio show in the history of the world, and I'm. Depending on who you talk to, I was kind of valuable to the show. Some people think more than others, and some people think less than others. But the bottom line is that I was a necessary element. And for the amount of money we were making, it wasn't one of those things. I always tell people, if somebody says you want to go work a week of comedy in Anchorage, you don't say no. You say $700,000. And then when they say, we're not going to give you that much, say, okay. You know, it's like saying to a girl in the bar, you know, will you have sex with me for $1 million? And she says, yeah. And well, how about for $2? And she says, go to hell. What kind of girl you think I am? And you say, well, we already know that. We just
price. I see. So you're saying, hey, you know what? You were pretty much ready to be done. But if they wanted to woo you, here's the number that would have gotten you excited.
But it wasn't quite that strong. Like, I did want to stay. So I wasn't given a number like $700,000 to go to Anchorage. It was like a number I thought I deserved. But I kind of drew a line in the sand for myself saying, you know what? If I wind up off the show, that's okay, too, because I was fried. 15 years of getting up at 4:30, and they're waggling money in front of my face to go to Las Vegas and Chicago. And if they're offering $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 to go have fun for the weekend, you don't say no to that. And so then here it is Monday again, and, you know.
Did I hear you say, right, that you did with the money that you made, you paid off the houses that you have on Long Island, you didn't end up with another $1 million in cash, but you ended up doing well, safe, and happy.
Well, I would have done unbelievable if I had been paying attention, because I got killed by the stock market crash. I got killed by the tech crash and my divorce. My wife did not take half my money. My wife earned half of my money. You know, we worked together. She made it so all I had to do was be funny for 20 years, which is a big deal. You know, like, look at what I just went through to get on the Skype with you. You know, I didn't have to worry about that for so long. So, if I had just paid attention and cashed out a little bit when I should have, I'd be way better than I am. But at some point I said, someday you're not going to have your job. Pay off those houses. And we had four houses. I paid for all of them. Nancy got three of them. And I got this beautiful home here. I'm on the water. I'm looking across at Stanford. I'm on Long Island Sound. I got a huge garage, a huge piece of land for Bayville, being on the water. And I really couldn't be happier. I haven't had a drink in 14 years. I actually haven't smoked pot in a couple of months.
Oh, wow.
You know, I almost talked myself into getting off coffee, and I said, son of a bitch.
No, you got to keep coffee in, especially if you're getting rid of everything else.
I was making 578, and I probably shouldn't be talking figures, but who cares?
Sure, who cares at this point?
And they offered me, it was 616 or 620, whatever it was. And my lawyer said, you know, we wanted $1 million. And they came back and said, all right, 650, that's our final offer. And he said, all right, I think he said 900. And that was in January of 2001. We never heard from them again. And I'm sitting there on the show every day.
I see. And your lawyer goes to them and says, hey, how about 900? They don't say anything, and then you walk off.
And so 2 months later, my lawyer says, you know, what are we gonna do? We're a stalemate. They won't return a call. They won't, you know, it was like our way or the highway, 650 or nothing. Which, in a fair way, 650 is a healthy leap from 580. I mean, I'm not lying to anybody. That was a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But I was shot. And just not even giving me the courtesy of negotiating So we went in and talked to the guy and said, listen, Tom's, Jackie's not coming in Monday, you know, because we're at a stalemate here. And he said, well, I think you're making a problem. I think you're making a mistake. And we said, well, we think you're making a mistake because, you know, Jackie's important to the show. So, of course, just that Monday, I didn't show up. And just like every time that I'd ever negotiated, they've known I'm not coming in on Monday. Because, of course, you would negotiate this with the general manager and, you know, make sure Howard knows, of course. And, of course, on Monday, I'm not there. And it's like, Robin, where's Jackie? Did he leave you high and dry again, Howard?
I see. I don't want to spend too much time on this. I wanted to get a little bit of insight into what happened when you left. But let's talk a little bit also about the high. And then we'll get into how you did it.
Okay. I didn't mean to go into such.
No. I'm the one who asked. Frankly, I've heard so much about the show. I never knew the number. I don't think you ever released the number. And I know they never released the number. So to me, that was eye-opening. But I want people to see, too, what you guys built. So what is the highest moment for you for doing that show? A time when you looked down and said, I can't believe we just did this.
Well, Howard kept, I mean, he's just a monumental genius, and he just kept reinventing. Like, when we first started getting popular, mm-hmm. you know, I'd get interviewed, and they'd say, you guys are so great, but how long can it last? You know, and then that was the interview after a year. That was the same interview 5 years later, 10 years later. You guys are great, but how long can it last? When he made the negotiation to go to Los Angeles, that was a big deal. A huge deal.
Why was getting into LA such a big deal?
Because it put us on the other, you know, two major coasts. You know, Infinity Broadcasting already had a station out there that was doing very well. So Howard's contract got him to be able to go to a station that wasn't an Infinity station, which is a big deal. And we really hit a home run out there. One of the major things is right after we got on the E! Channel and they started putting our faces up, people kind of knew us and people around here knew us. But Nancy and I, my wife and I, went for a charity thing in New Orleans. And we're up at Bourbon Street, up in one of those wrought iron tables, looking down at the tuba players and stuff. And nonchalantly, the waiter came over and said, hi, Jackie. Hi, Nancy. He not only knew me, he knew my wife.
Who wasn't on the show to that degree, you guys achieved fame.
It was like, wow, we must be getting somewhere. And then the premiere to private, I mean, his book parties were, I mean, the book signings that were crazy. But the premiere of the movie, and they shut down two blocks in New York City.
Yeah.
And it was the hugest event. And we walked like, you know, a 300-yard red carpet, and Howard came in the Pope-mobile. That was one of those nights that. And it was so amazing because something like that is really hard to relate to people, but they let us bring, I brought my wife and her family and my manager and my record company guy. So they were right there in the throes of it. And Andrew, it couldn't have been more exciting until we went to Los Angeles and repeated the same, you know, premiere in Los Angeles. And that's like, it's one thing, it's huge in New York, but that's your back door. But when you're in Los Angeles, my favorite story from the Los Angeles thing is we're at the Sky Bar after the premiere, and we're the toast of the town. And me and Stutter and John Melendez and Gary Delabate are at the Sky Bar upstairs, up the steps. And we're talking to John Stamos and George Clooney and Dean Cain. And we're shooting the breeze and getting drunk. And they're like, you guys, you know, because they were such huge fans of the show and they were so thrilled for us and blah, blah, blah. And we were on fire because we were like, almost equals, you know, on some level, because our movie was number one in the country. So Dean Cain and George Clooney kind of segue off to stand at the top of the stairs because all the beautiful girls are walking up and they're hitting on them as they come up the stairs. And we're drinking. And John Stamos turns to me and Stuttering John and Gary and says, look at those poor broads over there. They can't make up their minds. Superman or Batman?
And all that from a radio show, the money, the success, the recognition. And the way that you got on the show was you sent a package like this. Actually, it was your wife, your ex-wife, Nancy, who did it. This is one that you sent to my house. You sent me a T-shirt.
Well, we did have those. I'm going to show you what I sent. You want to see what I sent?
Yeah, let's see what you sent. This is.
Can you see that?
Yeah, what is that? What did you expect?
What did you expect? That's my class picture. I'm giving the finger.
Oh, that's the record. Oh.
I sent one record. Going Ape.
Uh-huh.
and normal people you don't know that well. By 1982, I had all three LPs, and we were sending copies of the record and the matching cassettes and all my promo to anybody that sneezed. And I was in Garvin's in Washington, D.C., and the owner of the club said, "This crazy man just got fired on the radio here, and he's going to NBC in New York. I bet you he'd love you. Why don't you look him up?" Mm-hmm. So I sent my three records blind to Howard Stern, care NBC,
AM. And you said,
I didn't have any idea.
You didn't go to you mailed it to them. And it was one of many packages you sent like that.
400.
Hoping to do what?
That somebody, I didn't know. You know, when they first started making micro cassette recorders, I sent a package. I think it was just my first album at that point. Every time an album came out, I sent packages again. But I sent my first album to Lanier Electronics, and it was like a Japanese firm, and they wrote me back and said, "We don't know what you're trying to do, but you have a lot of energy. You can have anything we have for free." You know, it's like I was throwing so much stuff against the wall. I mean, I wasn't looking to get on the radio. I don't know what I was looking for.
I see.
It wasn't like maybe I can get on the radio show. I'm thinking maybe he'll have me in. I can. I didn't know, Andrew. I really.
You know.
You ever hear about Columbus?
Uh huh.
The story of Columbus was he didn't know where he was going. When he got there, he didn't know where he was. And when he got home, he didn't know where he'd been. So it's the same thing.
That was you trying to figure it out, and you discovered America like that.
And a couple months later, he called up and said, "Hey, you know every joke. We love your records. You want to come in and judge a talent contest over the radio? You know, we're going to do a talent contest over the telephone." So I went in, 30 Rock, which was a long ways from Levittown, New York, and Governor's Comedy Club, and sat down with those guys, and we laughed for 4 hours. And at the end of the day, he said, "Man, you're fun. Why don't you come back next week?" Once a week for free for 3 years. Then he called me up and said, "We're going to mornings. I want you to be part of the team." And then we went to Pluto. The last rung that was incredible was when we got the CBS show on Saturday night to go against Saturday Night Live. That press conference, we're doing a press conference for Channel 2. You know, it's Channel 2 and, you know, CBS TV. You know, we're a dirty radio show. We got our own show on CBS TV.
You ended up on CBS? I thought it was Channel 9 in New York.
Channel 9 was 1989-90.
Okay.
In 1998, we did 2 years on Saturday nights across from Saturday Night Live.
I didn't realize that.
It was just amazing.
Hmm. Oh, actually, yes, at night. And then there was the Cindy Margolis show afterwards.
Maybe.
Or something like that. All right. I see. You sent those packages out. So in preparation for this interview, I went back and I BitTorrented the old radio shows, including the ones that Howard was doing back in Washington, D.C., the one the day after he was fired where he went onto a competitor's radio station and said, "We got fired. We're going to still perform here, and then we're moving to New York to be on NBC." The interesting thing about that period was it looked like he was experimenting to see if he could find the right people around him. He had, what did he call them? Not the mastermind, but something like that.
The brain.
It'll come to me later. It was a group of people who were all just there to be interesting and funny to play off
of. When I was there the first time, he said, you know, we used to have, not the brain trust.
I think it was the brain trust.
The something soup.
Okay.
Whatever it was. And he said, "We're trying to recreate that here, and you'd be perfect for it." You know, it's so funny that we can't think of it because, you know.
But it feels like he was looking for the dynamic. Who does he jive with? He had a whole bunch of people, and the people who he jived with were the ones who ended up on WXRK mornings, including you, and that's when he brought you in. Is that right? Was it that kind of exploratory period?
What happened was he worked with Fred, and then he went to Detroit and used to call Fred, and Fred would be on the air with him. And then when he went to D.C., he said he wanted to bring in Fred. So Fred came down and met him, and Fred was with him in D.C. Mm-hmm. And then, like in the movie, there was this woman who said, "Well, you know who'd be really good with you? This woman, Robin Quivers." And then Robin came to him, and they got it on really good. And then when he came to New York, I was sitting in with him one day a week, and then I started bringing in my friends, and they'd sit in, and we'd play Stump the Comedian. But over the time, I was slowly but surely, I was passing him notes. Handing him ideas and passing him notes more and more and more and more. And when I got the call to go to mornings, in 20 years, my total job description, he said, "Well, starting in mornings, I want you to be on the air with us 2 days a week and do your thing with the notes." That was my job description. Do your thing with the notes. And after 2 days a week, he was funnier when I was there. So within maybe about a month or maybe 2 months, I was there 5 days a week, and I was throwing lines. And he's such a genius that I'd write a line and throw it up there, and it would be seamless. Nobody had any idea for so long that I was throwing them lines.
Nobody knew, and I didn't know. I remember, and that's one of the magic. That's one piece of magic of the radio show. I don't know that other radio shows were doing this. It felt like coming up with all these jokes on the fly, but he had a writer.
Nobody had ever done that. And what was the beauty of it was I used to hand him little hunks, right? And then I said at some point, this is stupid. So I got a stack of 8x10, 8x11 paper and a Sharpie so I could write it decently and hand it to him. And then Fred, he never passed them stuff. Fred did a lot of writing for the show, but he never passed notes like that. He'd start writing a little scratchy thing and hand it to me, and I'd rewrite it. And at one point I said, Fred, and I put a stack of paper in front of him, and I said, write it big and clear so I can pass it to Howard, because by the time you give it to me and I rewrite it, the moment's going to be lost.
Right.
And you wouldn't believe over the course of 15 years how many times Fred handed me something that I'd already written and passed to Howard. I mean, we shared a brain. It was
such
great
rhythm.
So the point of it is, mm-hmm. Howard was brilliant. But Howard's brilliant, but I'm writing punchlines. And the way I described it was, it's like he's driving the car, and I'm reading the map. I don't care how good a driver you are. You can't read the map while you're driving. So he had his sense of humor, my punchline sense of humor, and Fred is from Pluto. So not only did he have three minds working, they were three good minds, if not great minds, but they were all completely different. So his sense of humor was like, had so many facets, you didn't know where it was going to come from. And it would, you know, so many times it would just freak people out, you know?
You know what? I read that Johnny Carson was surprised when he found out that his favorite broadcasters didn't write all of their own material. Then I found out about you. And then I was also I discovered that people in my industry don't write their own stuff. They don't write their own emails. In fact, and I resisted for a long time. I said, I have to write all my own stuff. If it's coming in under my name, I've got to write it from start to finish. And then I finally gave in and realized, no, the reality is behind the scenes, there's always a writer. And here at Mixergy, it's April often who will write the stuff that goes out under my name. And she's fantastic at it. And that's one of the secrets that people don't talk about. I feel a little weird talking about it here.
No, you know what? It's show business. Steve Allen wrote a book called The Funny Guys. The first one he did, The Funny Man, I think it was. And one of the stories about Eddie Cantor, who's like funny. He's the great-grandfather of a dear friend of mine, Lee Newman. Mm-hmm. And Eddie Cantor, like every vaudeville guy, he'd be on the road and he'd do his 7 minutes or his 10 minutes for years and years and years. And then he got his own radio show. And after 3 weeks, he didn't have anything. Yeah. Writers had already used all his stuff. So what they did was, they were comedy, and this is comedy writing. They went to the library and they got joke books and took jokes and twisted them, turned them, and formatted them to fit Eddie Cantor. And that's joke writing, because there's nothing new under the sun. My claim to fame, one of my main claim to fame, is I sold the two-bagger joke to Rodney Dangerfield. Do you know what that is?
Mm-mm.
Oh, Johnny, she was ugly. She was so ugly, she was known as a two-bagger. That's a girl that's not only got to put a bag over her head, you got to put a bag over your own head in case her head rips. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Didn't like that. A friend of mine called me from Peru, stoned out of his head on coke. A guy from Tennessee told him this joke about this girl who's called a Tennessee two-bagger because she was so ugly. It was an old Southern expression, but I got it. I took the Tennessee out of it and gave it to Rodney. It was the best joke he ever had. So many of his jokes, so many of everybody's jokes, they've been around forever and ever and ever. You know, I always tell people, if you think that you can come up with something about sex or farts or urination or disgust or snot or vomit, you think you could come up with something that nobody has thought of in the time since Adam and Eve? Do you know what kind of ego that takes to think that? I mean, everything you can think of has been done. And it's just
so I hear for copywriters, one of the exercises that professional copywriters will recommend is take the best copywriting you can find out there and rewrite it so that you get a sense of the rhythm of the writing, so that you get a sense of the structure of it, so that you get a sense of the details that you wouldn't pay attention to if you were just reading it. What's your process for learning how to tell jokes, how to write them?
I don't For the most part, I do not write jokes. My claim to fame is I know more jokes than anybody in the world, and I'm pretty sure I do. The Friars, yeah, the comedians, you know, most comedians, you know, a lot of them despise jokes or look down on jokes. Then you go to a party, what are they doing? They're telling jokes because everybody loves jokes. And the people that don't, fine. There's people that don't like opera, too. I always tell people, if you don't like jokes, don't go see Jackie the Joke Man. What are you, an idiot? But there are ways to make them. You know, people say, oh, you do jokes. You do old jokes. I go, all right, here's a stack of joke books. Go take a bunch of jokes and go stand on stage and tell them.
So what would you do? You would take the jokes. No. I know that you've collected jokes for years since you were a kid from what I read. What would you do when it's time to write? Would you wouldn't go back to those notes and say, I twist it? What do you
do?
The irony
of the whole thing was that I made my millions writing stuff for Howard on the fly that were never jokes. Mm-hmm. What I did for Howard was like if Howard's talking to Robin and I'm there, it's a three, picture Robin, Howard, and me are at dinner, okay? And we're having a conversation. And hopefully every once in a while I say something really funny because this sounds pompous, but I'm a very funny guy. I can be very funny in a situation. So Robin and Howard and me are at dinner. Except when I think of something very funny to say, instead of saying it, I write it down and give it to him to say it. So he's saying the funny things he's thinking of, and he's saying the funny things that I write down for him to say.
I see. So when you say you don't write jokes, you kind of are, because you're taking all the jokes that you've rewritten over the years for your own notes or learned or heard, and then they made you funny, and that's what's bringing out the comedy in the moment.
That's the process. That created the machine that, you know, everything I handed him, I don't think I handed him a regular joke in a million years. It was just all lines and quips and stupid things and crazy twists, and that's how I made my money. But my day job as a comedian is just old jokes. But over the period of time, I was a guy that was the last guy at the bar telling jokes. I was a musician till I was 31. I had no intention of being a comedian. We told jokes on you know, in the band, and we were a crazy, wacky duo and stuff. But I didn't go on stage to tell jokes as a comedian until I was 31 years old, which is, you know, that's a lifetime before you get to the stage. But my whole life I had told jokes and been told jokes and been telling them. So I inherently know what I can make work if I'm telling you a joke, which means I know it can, when I'm telling jokes to 1,000 people or 5 people at the bar, I'm telling that joke the way I know it's going to work. And there's certain, you know, you take off all the trimmings. You know, you tell somebody tells you a joke in a bar and there's so much garbage in it.
I see. So you're practicing it in one-on-one conversations. You get a sense of the rhythm and what's funny and what needs to be changed. And that's what allows you to tell jokes on stage. I want to ask you about one other thing beyond comedy. Something that again, in my research, I found that Bill Nosel, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing his last name right, but he was a program director at WCCC.
I didn't hear that fell out.
Bill Nosel? Anyway, he was a program director who said that Howard was always on the phone to local TV stations and news reporters. He kept promoting. He was one of the world's best self-promoters. Did you find any of that? Because it wasn't just that you guys were funny, but other people were talking about what you were doing, which drew in new listeners. What was that process like?
With him, he got to the point where he hit the tipping point. So people were doing that bidding for him. Just like me, you know, you knock on doors and knock on doors and knock on doors and knock on doors. It's like tag, you're it. You're chasing, and all of a sudden at some point they turn around and they're chasing you.
Are you saying that by the time you were working with him, they were chasing you guys?
Well, he was just starting the turn, you know? And it was an amazing thing to watch. Like when he got to NBC, one of the Tuesdays I was there, they were doing a television piece on him. But it wasn't NBC. It was CBS TV doing a news piece on on an NBC employee. So that's when I said, wow.
This is big. This, so what did he do if you needed, or what did you guys do if you needed press, if you needed people to talk about you? Were there things that you would do?
Well, he did like a Playboy interview and stuff. But people would come to us and you know, they couldn't get to him for the most part. So they'd interview me, then interview Fred, and I was out there, you know, going to all the different markets, performing, and the other markets loved me because they couldn't get anybody else, so they would take me, you know, and we'd go from bar to bar. But everybody wanted, and after the tipping point got turned, he was not reachable, which you know.
I see. So you're saying,
prize, which was there was a beauty to that, you know,
to being unreachable. What's the benefit of being unreachable?
Well, when you're big enough, you know what I mean. It creates desire.
You know I see. What I mean? That if they can't get you.
I was not in on those decisions, so I can't take any credit for the way that they played it. But obviously, you know, he knew what he was doing, and he would only do things where he's going to succeed. And the Channel 9 TV show, people every day still talk to me about it. I ran into Eddie Murphy at the China Club in like 1990, and I went up and said, "How you doing, Eddie?" Because we had started, you know, 10 years before or whatever. And he goes, "Jack, that Channel 9 show, that's the funniest stuff on television. And no, I'm not going to do the show." Everybody loved it, you know.
What about this? Here, I'll give you an example. I was listening to an old episode where Letterman was leaving for CBS and Howard said, "They're talking to me about taking over for Letterman." And he was just talking about it. And you said, "Oh yeah, they're talking to me too." And I sensed in that moment what you were saying is, hey, we're clearly puffing something here. There aren't conversations, but we're trying to get people to think that they are so that they see us bigger than we are.
You never knew.
Right.
You never knew what was – I was sitting there. Me and Fred are sitting there, and we were never – at one point, he's talking about how Michael Jackson called him up. Michael Jackson wanted his help getting to untarnish his name. And we're like, there goes Howard again. It was true. He had meetings with Michael Jackson and said no to Michael Jackson, and that was absolutely documented true. And if anything sounded like he made it up, you know – and he says, "Oh, yeah, I'm going to support the candidate for governor of New Jersey. First one who calls. Ha, ha, ha." And she called. Who was it? Christy Whitman? What was her name?
Yes.
She called up and he said, "I want my name on an outhouse." And she got his support. And that might have helped her win. You don't know.
And that,
you know,
he went for governor. That would come up on the fly? Or did you guys write that the night before?
It just all of a sudden, it's so funny because so many things happened that were so huge, and so many of the things he just thought of, so many of the things he thought of on the spur of the moment, so many things he or me or Fred thought of on the spur of the moment, that I would never take credit or not take credit for so many things because I honestly don't know. And like, how could you not remember a concept like first one calls gets me? But if you think about how, you know.
But would there be writing sessions where you would say, we need to come up with a way to get people's attention? Not just to do a funny bit, but to get people's attention. Where do we do that? No.
That was the elephant in the room. Everything we were doing, everything he was doing was to get attention.
Okay.
You know, everybody in the world loved Carson, so he didn't like Carson. You know what I mean? It was like, you know, he had a small penis because that would relax men. As much as that, you know, sounds absurd. You know, he told everybody he was, you know, half Jewish and half Italian because he wanted all the Long Islanders to listen. You know, just whatever worked. And, you know, and the bottom line is we just wanted to be funny. You know, when I first started there and we started writing, I'd go, "Nah." And he'd go, "Listen, don't ever say now," because he'd see I had something to say and I wouldn't say it. I wouldn't write it down. He said, "Anything you think of, you write down or tell me. I'll do the editing." So I never ever held back. And there were a couple times I passed him something on the air where he looked over at me like I had two heads, like, "What's wrong with you?" And I'm like, "Man, you know."
What kind of things would get Howard Stern to say, "This is too far"?
There was a horrible, horrible story about some, you know, yeehaws, some rednecks in Texas had tied a rope to a black guy and pulled him, tied the rope to him and tied the rope to the back of their truck and pulled him to his death.
I remember that.
Which was about as horrible a story as you could think of. And I wrote a note and passed it to him and he almost fell off his chair. And he said, "We'll be right back," you know. And all the note said was Polish water skiing, which is just so dark. But it was a joke, you know.
And that got him to laugh. And so much that he couldn't continue, but he knew that's not what you say on the radio.
No, absolutely not. Because how many, you know, it was like making light, but, you know, there's nothing you could do. You know, there was, that happened Not a lot of times. That might have happened 5 times. Maybe a few more, maybe a few less. But, you know, it was just so wrong, you know. But it was crazy. I remember we were sitting in a writing session, and Cher had just started dating a guy that sold bagels in Queens, mm-hmm. which was such a huge story. It was so crazy. And so, of course, we're going to make fun of the story. And so we're going to write a parody to I've Got You, Babe. You remember, I Got You, Babe, yep. You know that song by Sonny Cher. So we're writing and writing, and we just throw ideas and Howard write down what he liked. And all of a sudden, I just smiled and I said, nah, you know. And that was, I think that might have been the time when he said, don't edit. He said, what? I said, no, it's too stupid. You know, I don't want you guys to think I'm an idiot. What is it? And in the middle section of the song, the B section of the song, I said, I've got flowers in the spring. I've got you to wear my ring. And when I'm sad and when I'm down, I could tear your love around. And the second 2 lines of the bridge, I said, I see. And this was a Queens guy, Rob Famoletti, who was singing. It was Fred singing as
the bagel guy.
Cher's bagel guy. And the last 2 lines of the bridge was, I see London, I see France, I saw Cher in her underpants. And Howard fell off the floor. It was the funniest line in the song. I'm sure they still play that on the air. And it was like, and I wouldn't have said it out loud because I was embarrassed how dopey it was. But that was the genius of the show. We would have, you know, Howard really, he's just so talented. He knew enough to take the lowest of the low, stupid, and put it with this really, really smart witticism or cynicism. And it just, and you know, and that's
what about you, as the guy who was writing, who people didn't know was writing a lot of these jokes, how did it feel to not be recognized for the work that you'd been writing?
I was making money. I was thrilled.
But you're a performer. You like to get credit for
it. I get my yayas, and I was going, you know, it's so funny. People say, oh, you can always tell when Jackie wrote a joke. Or wrote a line because he laughed so hard, which is essentially true, but not true, because I'm an equal opportunity laugher. Mm-hmm. And people get mad at me for the way I talk about it, because if Howard says, Robin, I think I'm going to go buy new shoes after the show, she'll hey, Robin, you know, and tell a funny joke. Hey, Robin, the sky is blue. She has the same stock laugh all the time. And I would laugh in accordance to how funny something is, because that's what I've always done. Of course, a lot of things I wrote, I thought were funny, or I wouldn't have written them down.
So you weren't feeling, hey, I wrote that. Somebody needs to have, at the end of this show, a writer's credit that I was the one who was writing a lot of the stuff that you guys all laughed at.
Let me finish what I was telling you. Okay. So Fred is also handing stuff to me, and I'm handing it to Howard, and Howard's saying stuff on his own, but I laughed at everything. But I wrote a lot of stuff, so I laughed hard. And I'd come home, and Nancy would say, wow, the funniest thing you wrote today was such and such. And I go, I didn't write that. Fred wrote that. And she'd say, but you laugh so hard at it. I said, I don't just laugh when I say something, when I do something funny. Sometimes you say the funniest thing today was this. And I'd say, Howard thought of that on his own. Because I would roar at whatever happened. You know, at first, it was so crazy because nobody knew at all. And there was a great story when they were doing an oldies but goodies test, and the members of Congress couldn't answer the oldies but goodies because the oldies but goodies were too recent. They could answer about Dion and about Chuck Berry, but they didn't know. So Robin's giving Howard the test. So of course me and Fred are cheating. And Robin says, what were some of the hits for Gary U.S. Bonds?
Okay.
And Howard remembered this little girl and he couldn't think. So I took my Sharpie and I wrote 2:45. Because one of Gary U.S. Bonds' biggest hits was 2:45. So I wrote 2:45 and put it up. And Howard said 2:45. And Robin and Fred screamed and screamed. And in my mind, I'm saying, you know what? That's going to let everybody on to the fact that somebody's writing this stuff.
Yeah.
And the word is out. Nobody ever mentioned it. Nobody had any idea, you know. And it didn't matter. It was just so. He's like, you idiot, if we're going to cheat, at least help me, you know, so it makes sense. But slowly but surely, but there were no credits on the radio show. When we went to Channel 9, they said, all right, we're going to make you guys producers or line producers. And I said, no. I said, we're writers. I said, well, you can't have writing credit because it's not a guild show. I said, you know what? we're going to be writers. In fact, I'm the last one who decides what Howard's going to see. So I'm the head writer. And they're like, well, Fred's been here longer than you. And I said, well, but I'm the last one to hand Howard the note. And they go, well, Fred can't do that because he's doing the sound. I said, I don't want to be called the sound man. I want to be called the head writer. I'm the one that's handing it, you know. And I fought for it. And they made fun of me incessantly on that show for the rest. I'm the head writer.
But I was,
you know. And it was a great, great credit because it was what I always had been. But, you know. Actually said, you know, one time in an interview, I was telling somebody what I did, and I'd hand stuff to Howard on the fly, and I said, I'm a flying gag writer. And they must have said that 1,000 times, but I thought that was a great description.
See, it sounded on the radio to me.
We'd go to Cleveland, we'd go to Los Angeles, and all of a sudden we'd be doing a live broadcast. And somebody said, you know, the local reviewer would be like, it was amazing. We watched Jackie Martling flying with the notes, passing the notes to Howard, and that these guys are so seamless. You know, it was so slowly but surely it came out. But I wasn't, I just wanted to get paid. I was part of the greatest radio show ever, and just being there and being part of it, you know.
What about this? You've been very open in this conversation. This is something that is not very businessy, but it's still important. You had all these women around you. You couldn't have stayed monogamous the whole time you were doing the show when all these women were throwing themselves at you. Could you have?
Yes, because
uh-huh.
They were not throwing themselves at me. They were throwing themselves at Howard. You know, it's funny. My friend David Say opened up for Frankie Valli for years. And they're in the dressing room in the later years. And Frankie Valli says, I got a note from some girl. She said she wants to give me oral sex. And David Say said, see, that's funny, Frank. I got the same note. And Frankie was a little annoyed. He says, you got the same note? And David said, yeah. The note says, tell Frankie I want oral sex. You know, they would have done anything.
You're saying you had no opportunities with all those women there? You promise right here, you swear you had no extramarital activities.
Yeah. No, you have opportunities, but, you know, it's just like the girl. People say, was it true what happened in the studio? Yes. The only thing that wasn't true was how the girls looked. You know what I mean? I don't know. Radio groupies, you know, and the Stern fans that would come out, it's not like rock and roll groupies. Like, I don't know who used to say it, but like the greatest comedian in the world, you know, you could be in the worst band. You could be a bass player in the worst band in the world playing a low-rent gig. And at the end of your set, a beautiful girl comes up and says, here's my phone number. And if you're a comedian at Carnegie Hall and you walk off stage, a woman will come up and say, my husband thinks you're funny. You know, it's just a different level. You know, I mean, I got many more girls in the 70s when I was a low-rent, horrible guitar player in a horrible band. You know, it was just a different thing.
So no extramarital relationships for you?
No.
Wow.
Well, not only that. Everybody wanted to get to Howard. Think about it the other way. Everybody wanted to get to Howard. So if I fiddled around with a girl, what's the first thing she's going
to
do?
Go to Howard. That doesn't stop a guy. Guys have a hard time resisting.
I can't believe if a girl had called up and said, Jackie, Howard, I spent the night with Jackie last night. I'd have been guilty if the girl completely made it up. I can't believe in all those years no girl ever called up and just said that.
Right.
To get us in trouble.
You want to know something that I discovered, again, behind the scenes stuff? Now that I'm in San Francisco, I see software developers and entrepreneurs who have what's called God View on their app. This lets them see everything that's being done by the users of their app. I've seen men connect with women that way and then end up dating them.
Explain that again.
Imagine you are a user of an app and the founder of the company has access to what you're doing on the app because he has something called God View, because he can see what everyone is doing on the app.
But that's not inherent to what you're buying. In other words, you're buying something that's going to show you.
People just don't recognize that founders have that kind of power.
Wow.
Yeah, right? It blows your mind, right? It kind of is very scary. It keeps me from wanting to put stuff in apps.
Yeah, somebody just told me if you get that flashlight app, that enables people to follow you no matter where you go. It's like a homing device. I never knew any of that.
I heard that. That was on Hacker News a few weeks ago.
I will tell you one thing, though.
Yes?
I will tell you to the penny how much money I made. what I did and didn't do with women, I would never.
Why not?
I didn't, but I wouldn't have anyway, because as low life and crazy and filthy as my act is, you know, kiss and tell doesn't work for anybody, you know, especially if I was with men. I'm not going to tell you that either.
Why not?
You're just smiling. Now, you and I, that's not true. Now, how do you know that's not true? I could be a sensitive guy and be with men.
Did you feel, sometimes I feel as I listen to interviewees, I think, boy, they're doing something big. I need to do something bigger with my life because I'm surrounded by these people who are leaving huge marks on the world. Did you ever feel that way?
Andrew, I'm talking to you from the North Shore of Nassau County, okay? It's the Gold Coast. This is the most amazing place in the world. Down the street at Center Island is Billy Joel.
Are you saying that's enough for you? Don't you aspire for more? No.
At the point, Billy Joel, Fortunoff, okay. John Barry, the composer, the untold wealth here, you know, the rock, you name them. The Piping Rock Country Club, the Creek Club is a mile down the road. This is the wealthy, this is the people that are so rich, like the Baker Estate. George Baker started Citibank. He was the guy that gave the money to the upstarts to get going. The upstarts like Vanderbilt Shipping and Rockefeller's Steel. He's the guy that gave them the money.
And they're your neighbors.
I live in $1.5 million house. And I get depressed, and people say, how could you get depressed? I say, people say, how could you be depressed? Because you live better than 99.9% of the world's population. How can you be depressed? I say, because the other 0.01% are my freaking neighbors. Okay, so you get intimidated, but I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, I didn't do major things. I mean, Howard is at the top, the cream to the cream, and I was 3 feet away from him, but I wasn't 3 feet away from him, right. You know. In the echelon, I know how much I had to do with how big he got and how funny he got. You know, I talked to people that heard him in Washington, D.C., and they said, you know what? When you heard him in D.C., he was outrageous and funny. And once you started writing for him, he was funny and outrageous, which sounds subtle, but it's a big difference. If you can laugh at yourself and turn it around, it's amazing, just like with a bully. If you can make somebody laugh, people like to have you around, you know, like – Howard was never self-effacing, and I'll never forget when I first started in mornings, he was complaining about something, and I wrote a note, and I can remember handing it to him, and he took pause, but then he said it, and you could almost hear Fred and Robin gasp, because he hadn't said anything like that before, like, he's complaining, and all of a sudden, I hand him a note, and he goes, walk a mile in my nose, Robin. It was really funny, but it was self-facing, and it was like it popped the balloon, and you start over. You know, I it's Andrew. I don't mean to sound pompous, but I'm just telling you, you know, where I'm coming from. You know, and
that would make me especially what I said at the top.
People doing so many things. I know exactly what you're talking about.
What I said at the top of the interview, where he would get on the air and say, "You have to have Eye of the Tiger. We have to." I don't remember how he phrased it, but we have to crush the competition, put down other people to get ahead and all that stuff. And you're there listening to this and taking this stuff in. You've got to feel like, I got to do the same thing too. Why is there any other comedian on the planet who's doing better than me? Eddie Murphy is not funnier than me. I got to beat him.
You know, I never had that kind of...
No?
I had beaten myself into the ground for so long. I was 31 when I started telling jokes. When I got on the Stern Show... You know, when we went to mornings, I was 37 years old. That was my first paycheck. You know, like I was thrilled that, you know, you're getting up at 4:30. Who cared? I was thrilled to be there. I was a comedian who got to sleep in his own bed. You know, it's funny because like you're talking about, other people are doing better. You know, my old friend Rich Jenny, all of a sudden he gets a sitcom. And I'm like, son of a gun, look, he's got a sitcom and I'm stuck here. But a year later, his sitcom was canceled and we were in 10 extra markets. So it was the tortoise and the hare, you know, right. Like John Mendoza got a show and this guy got a show and I loved all these guys and they were all my friends and everybody was having their turn in the barrel. But my turn in the barrel was slow and steady wins the race. And I could have been out of that show so many times. Those 3 times I walked out, you know, there was one time I was gone for like 6 weeks, but it's a very weird thing. And I do see so many, you know, I'm like, how come this guy, everybody's in the movies but me? But for 15 years, I couldn't do anything else. They're physically, it's not like they were calling and I was turning them down. But, you know, people say, what would you have done if you hadn't run into Howard Stern? I would have run into somebody else. You know, I would have kept sending those albums till I bumped into something. You know, you never know you don't know the answer to that question. You know what I mean?
The name, The Joke Man, who gave that to you?
You know, that's a great, you know, I started Joke Line when we started comedy on Long Island. I didn't start in comedy on Long Island. When I started in comedy, we started comedy. It mm-hmm. was upstairs at a restaurant called Cinnamon in Huntington. And me and this guy, Richie Minervini, put on a show. And we'd have the comedians out from the city and we'd pay them money and they'd have fun and meet girls. And they were like thrilled, right? And then that grew into the East Side Comedy Club, which was the first comedy club on Long Island and on the East Coast, except for the Improv and Catch. And it was a standalone comedy club. And all of a sudden, the whole boom started. We helped start the boom. And I was like, how are we going to get people to our show at Cinnamon? And I got the bright idea, which isn't my idea at all. I'll get a joke line. I'll tell a joke. Then I'll say where we're going to be. And then I'll tell another joke. So I went and I asked for a certain, you know, it's a long story, but I wound up with 516-922-WINE, which is still going 36 years later. If somebody dials right now, 516-922-9463. Hello, this is Jackie. Thanks for using your finger. This week I'm going to be at the Cutting Room in New York City on April Fool's Day, blah, 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 and they tell a dirty joke. So I started calling myself Jackie 922-WINE Martling. And I'm promoting shows at Governor's, and I'm Jackie 922-WINE Martling. Rick Dees in California was a famous disc jockey, and somebody had turned him on to 922-WINE, and he was calling my joke line and recording the jokes and putting them on his weekly top 40 countdown. And there's a whole more story, but I'm not going to bore you with it. But in 1979, the world was starting to change. All of a sudden, there was HBO. And all of a sudden, you're sitting in the living room watching television, and there's a pair of naked breasts on the television on HBO, which sounds like nothing now, but it was so foreign. Mm-hmm. And everything got a little naughtier and a little naughtier. So I started making 922-WINE dirtier and dirtier and dirtier. And one day, Rick Dees called me up and said, Jack, I've been stealing your jokes and giving you credit and putting them on my weekly top 40, but now they're all too dirty. Can you do some clean jokes for me? I said, okay. He said, how about we say you're a madman from New York, who knows all the jokes, and we'll call you Jackie the Joke Man Martling. I said, fine. So the whole world thinks that Howard named me Jackie the Joke Man Martling, and it was Rick Dees, who was Howard's polar opposite.
You guys competed with. And so when you heard the attacks against Rick Dees, how did you feel, the guy who gave you the name?
Well, he named me that because, you know, he gave me that name because I was doing jokes for him. It was a business thing. And it doesn't matter what you say. People say, how did you let Howard say the stuff on the air that he used to say to you? And I say, you don't understand. Some of those things he's saying to me, I'm writing. People can't wrap their brain around, you know, here, Howard, you know, Jackie, what? He's looking down. Jackie, what kind of moron are you? You know, it's like, it was theater. It was all theater. I'll tell you, when it got a little crazy, when he'd start talking about man cows, father being dead, and I want to have sex with his dead father's skull, I wanted to hold up a note that said, everything that's said on the show doesn't represent the opinions of everybody in the room.
That's where you wanted to distance yourself. It wasn't even the friendship that you had with Rick Dees. It was when it went to somebody's father dying.
Well, you know, it's just a place that I wouldn't go, you know, like, but I didn't fault him because he knew, you know, that was him. You know, whenever I start talking to him, I always tell people, look, I don't fault him because whatever he's done to me or not done to me or given to me or not given to me, that's the animal. That's the animal he is. You know, you can't have it both ways. You know, the thing that made him that crazy eye of the tiger, got to have all the marbles, fight, 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 I want it all, step on this guy, you know, that's what got him.
That's
where
what
he
it
is.
Was. And when you're getting on the air, when he's getting on the air and saying, man, cow's dad, etc., that's the inner hunger to beat the competition coming through. It's not a show to get another few more listeners or to shock people into paying attention.
All of the above.
All of the above.
It's hoping that people didn't think I was writing, here's something to say, I want to have sex with his father's skull. You know, I mean, that was not.
Internally, when you guys were fighting for the ratings, when you guys were fighting to get more, what was that, were those meetings like internally? How do we crush the competition? What was that like?
We just come up, you know, with stupid idea after stupid idea. You know, it was just be funnier and be wilder and come up with all kinds of crazy stuff. You know, all roads led to Rome. It wasn't like there was a plotted out plan, you know. And it was funny because he would attack a guy and then we go to another market. And after a certain amount of markets, you know, you couldn't attack everybody. So it kind of backed off because you couldn't. There was too many other markets to spearhead.
Too confusing to keep track of all the people you guys were competing with. Right, who is he attacking today? Wait, what market was that? There was a guy in Cleveland, but what about the guy in this other city? Well, I don't even know where that city is.
Right. It was like it just stopped, you know.
But internally, did you feel that way too? Internally, did you feel like we have to crush the competition? Why are we not working harder? Why are we not writing more jokes? Why is...
I never, in my mind, it was never about crushing the competition. In my mind, it was the funnier we are and more entertaining we are, that's going to do the job, you know. But he knew how to go about it his way, and I knew what I could contribute was making it funnier.
And were there daily, there were daily writing sessions after each show too?
For a long time. Towards the end, we were just such a smooth operation. We'd just all walk in and sit down, and he'd open his mouth, and at 11:30, he'd shut up. I mean, we were such a finely tuned mechanism. That's why, you know, everybody's mad at me for leaving, but I didn't leave. I just wanted a little bit more of the pie. I didn't want to break up the... You know, they always made fun of me because they called us the Beatles of radio. But Jesus, we were the Beatles of radio. We really were. And I wanted to get paid more. And it was like, well, Jackie, you're getting paid plenty. And it was like telling Ringo, you're getting a lot of money. You're a drummer and you're making a lot of money for a drummer. It's like, no, I'm not a drummer. I'm the drummer in the Beatles.
I'm a Beatle. So how much money did the show make? You were starting to say it at the top of the interview and I cut you off.
I don't know. I don't know. They were just printing money. Just printing money. And in the beginning, we would... After the show, Howard would sit there, and me and Fred would sit there, and a couple of people flow in and out, and if we had a guest, they'd hang around for a few minutes. Sometimes Robin would hang around for a few minutes, maybe the interns. But Howard would sit there, and me and Fred would throw ideas, and Howard write them down. We'd throw down ideas, and maybe we'd come up with an idea for a song, or maybe me and Fred would bring in ideas for this, that. And we'd sit there sometimes for – sometimes we wouldn't. Sometimes we'd sit for 10 minutes. Sometimes we'd sit for an hour. But it was a joy. It was a writing session, but it was me, Howard, and Fred hanging out and laughing our balls off. You know what I mean? It was just, you know, and telling stories. And it's really funny, Andrew, because we'd sit there and Howard would tell a story and Fred would tell a story and then I'd tell a story. And it seemed like, you know, those guys sat and watched television for their childhoods and I was out being an idiot. So my stories would always trump them, and I'd be in the middle of one of my stories, and I'd see Gary and Fred and Howard looking at each other and kind of rolling their eyes like, there he goes again. The most famous stories I told on the air, they didn't make it to the air for months and months. I'd tell them a story, and then it took them enough time of getting to know me to where they were like, you know what? I bet that story about throwing urine in his mother's face is true, which it absolutely was. But when I told it, they're like, oh, boy, you know, here he goes with another one of his whoppers. And it got to the point where they knew when I was telling a story, I didn't have to exaggerate. I wasn't especially proud of my stories, but they were things that really happened. So, you know, it was the way the whole thing developed. It was storybook, really storybook.
It really was.
It was Dorothy on the way to Oz. She, you know, Howard got Fred, and then he got Robin, and then he got me. And then Gary, and then John. I was surprised that nobody ever said, "Why don't we make a movie where it's the Wizard of Radio or whatever?"
Kind of did. Private Parts was like that. By the way, I see that more sun is coming in your face. Do you want to tilt your computer a bit?
You tell me.
Let's do it. Let's tilt it out. I want you to feel a little comfortable.
No, you don't know what it's like. It was 7 degrees here 2 days ago, so the sun couldn't be more welcome where I am. Is that better?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. So what are you up to now?
Well, we have a meeting tomorrow because we're going to create the Jokeland Screaming Streaming Podcast. We're going to videotape, audio tape, and I have a couple guest bedrooms, and we're on the North Shore of Long Island, and this is a beautiful home and a great place to hang out, and we're going to have dinners and parties and videotape everything and do a podcast broadcast. We don't know exactly what we're going to do, but we're
going to try. But you're starting to create your own podcast too.
Right, and so I own my content. And I'm, you know, it's funny, I don't know what's exactly happening, but my comedy star is kind of going up again. It's like, it's kind of like Henny Youngman. Like, people made fun of him and made fun of him, and all of a sudden one day people are like, wow, that guy's really funny. Like, I haven't had a bad show for 40 years. I've just been killing audiences with these stupid jokes, and I love them, and people love them. And all of a sudden, you know, kids are hearing the jokes on Pandora and Spotify and on Sirius 99 Raw Dog. And, you know, there's like 23-year-old kids like emailing me, say, who the hell are you? Like, you know, my father never told me about you, or my grandfather never told me about you. So, because the jokes are the jokes. You know, I was laughing at these jokes when I was 12 years old, you know. So I'm having a little bit of a resurgence. So I'm getting some gigs that are, you know, really, really fun. I was just out in Las Vegas at the South Point for Super Bowl weekend. And yeah. It was me and Bobby Slayton. And it was just like, it was like the old days at the Rib. I mean, we were killing, you know, and hanging out. You know, no Andrew, there were no groupies.
I don't buy that.
No, you shouldn't.
You know why I don't buy it? Because I remember being an awkward internet guy going to Vegas, and oh, actually, I never had sex in Vegas with anyone either. But women were interested in me. I just wasn't. I didn't even know what to do with it.
You didn't know how to pull the trigger.
Yeah, so that's why I say, look, you're a guy who's up on stage. Any performer, anyone who could speak comfortably, anyone who's had the experience that you had, must have tons of people, tons of women coming to you.
I'm up there telling filthy jokes. You know, it's, you know, you know what? I'm going to send you pictures after my next show. I'm going to send you the pictures of the people that came up and like, hey, you want to go for a beer, you know?
Okay, all right. I'd like to see that.
And the pretty ones are not there alone.
That makes sense. Plus, it sounds like you're not going clubbing afterwards.
No, but you know, I did it. Everybody that goes in the, you know, you start playing guitar so you can meet girls or meet more girls or meet a better class of girls. You know, the day you put down your guitar, you might as well slice off your Johnson at this
point. So the podcast is going to happen from your place. You're self-publishing it. You're not going, I don't understand some of these publishing networks. They give you nothing.
No, that makes no sense, especially in this day and age. You know, what's so funny is I was the king of the homegrown. You know, yeah. I was the. Nowadays, you can't go to a comedy show where the comedian doesn't sell his CDs or his albums or something. I was the first guy that ever did that because I worked in a recording studio in the 70s, and I was only in comedy for 6 months. There was no such thing as a comedy club yet. And this bar where we promoted these shows, I recorded my first album on a cassette player in a bar room, and my album came out like 6 months later, you know, and I'm standing there. People, the guys would make fun of me because I'd be standing there walking my albums. And all of a sudden one day you could hear them go like, wait a minute, we made $40 a piece tonight. And Martley made an extra 75 because he sold 15 albums.
Where'd you get the guts to do that? That actually, that people laugh at that, but, or they did on the show, but that takes guts to take yourself off the stage where most people are nervous anyway, and to stand out there and say, now I want to sell you something. Now this guy who you had this vision of greatness for is going to try to get money from you. That takes a lot of guts.
Well, let me tell you where I was coming from. I have always told jokes. I've heard them, repeated them, honed them down. And when I'm telling you a joke, I'm not telling you a joke because I want you to hand me a quarter. I'm telling you a joke because I want to make you laugh.
But you're not handing them CDs or records or whatever. You're selling it. That takes guts, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, I'm telling you jokes, and the dirtier and crazier and faster they are, it's like punching you in the stomach. If I can make you guffaw, that makes me very happy. And the idea of sharing these jokes is a great thing. So I'd always done it my whole life. So all of a sudden I'm on stage, and I came home one night from the barroom, and I said to my girlfriend, I said, they laughed at every single joke. I should make an album. And she goes, yeah, you should make an album. Why don't you do it? So I did it. And I borrowed $100 from 15 different people, took my class picture with me giving the finger in eighth grade, and chopped it up, edited it, put the whole thing together, sent it to Nashville. When I went to pick up my albums at Port Authority, you would have thought I was picking up my triplets, right? And I was so excited. But to me, when I was selling my albums, I wasn't saying, take Jackie home with you. It was, take these jokes home with you. I don't know if that was a conscious thing, but it wasn't like, here, take home a picture of me. Do you want an autographed picture? It was like, you know, people, because people say, God, those jokes are so great. I wish I could remember some of them. And here's an album full of them. So it was, it wasn't like,
it just didn't come across to you as, it didn't feel to you like something that was awkward or should have made you nervous. You just felt comfortable with it.
It took me 30 years to collect these jokes, and I'm handing you the best of what I got for $5 on a record. I did all the work. All you got, you know, and people loved it. And people love to take something home. And, you know, sometimes they'd ask the other comedians to sign them too. And they'd like, after they just got done goofing on me, you'd see how much they'd light up signing their name because they,
you know what, I do see it today when I leave a comedy club or walk with, leave the show within a comedy club, there's a guy often standing there with his CDs, and I've never seen them feel confident about it. I've never seen them say, hey, I'm selling this. It's almost like if you look their way, then they hint that they're selling, and then they maybe show one to you and hope that you say, are you selling it? Can I give you my money? Which doesn't happen.
Do you want to hear the 180 degrees to that?
Yeah, what's that?
When I do my show, at the end of my show, I play Stump the Joke Man. Stump the Joke Man t-shirts.
Yep, I know it.
I bring girls up on stage, and I insult them and talk to them and have fun with them. Then I play with the guys. The guys raise their hand. They ask a joke. I say the answer. And if I don't know the answer, they get a shirt. And it's always fun and always funny. And I'll do the girls. And if there's four girls on stage, what's your joke, blah, 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 what's your joke, blah, 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 what's your joke, and I get to the last girl, I hand them all CDs or DVDs, hand the last girl a microphone, they say, stand there, and I pick up my bags, and they say, what are you doing? I say, I'm going to the back of the room so I can be standing there when the show's over so these people have to feel guilty walking past me if they don't buy something. I turn it, I put it right in their face. And I go out there, the girl yells the joke, I yell the punchline, I yell goodnight, and the people are screaming, and they come walking past me, but they're not intimidated, they shake hands, they take a picture, sometimes they buy something, sometimes they don't.
I see, and you make it part of the act.
I make qualms about it, you know, you want to buy something, here I am, you know.
Oh, that's cool, all right. So the podcast, I'm guessing it will be on jokeland.com?
Yeah, and it'll be, we're going to scream it from the rooftops, because I know a lot of people... Radio stations everywhere love to have me as a guest because they all want to ask questions about the Howard Stern Show. And as you can see, I'm always willing to talk about it.
I love that you're out there talking. Frankly, I don't listen to radio anymore. I listen to podcasts. I hear you on podcasts. I'm into it.
It's so fun. I did Penn Jillette's the other day with Bobby Slayton. I did Louis Anderson's. I had Anthony Kamea from Opie and Anthony offered me my own show on his channel. But I said, you know, it makes no sense to go to work for somebody else. You know, there's a lot of great, great podcasts out there, and the guys are all so funny.
Yeah, and then you become a guest on all the other joke podcasts, the comedy podcasts. They always will refer back to you and your show. You'll get people to come and watch and listen. Actually, you're not going to do video. You're going to do audio, right?
Well, we're going to do both, but it's incestuous because everybody helps everybody because once you listen, you know, you got to listen. Like, I walked today for 2 hours. And I listen to Alec Baldwin, Here's the Thing, which is just amazing.
He's really good.
And then Radio Lab and This American Life and Kevin Pollak is amazing. And there's just so many great ones, just so many great ones. And I want to be part of it because, you know, it's so funny. I'm listening to Kevin Pollak and it's so interesting. And he's interviewing Billy Bob Thornton. And Billy Bob's telling a story about when he was a waiter and how he was waiting on you know, just the cream of Hollywood by accident. And Billy Wilder says to him, oh, so you want to be an actor, huh? And he goes, yeah, how'd you know? He said, well, you're a waiter in Hollywood. Billy Wilder took a shining to him and took him to some thing where he won an award. And he said, Billy Wilder he went to the microphone, he didn't even thank anybody. All he said was, and then Billy Bob just told the joke that Billy Wilder had told. And it was a simple, mundane joke like I must have heard 40 years ago. And everybody in Kevin's room went crazy. Because everybody loves a joke. And that just cemented, you know, like, and there's so many stories about him. So, yes, it's going to be a great podcast, great fun. And we're going to get people from my Twitter. Tell them my Twitter, my friend.
Twitter is at Jackie Martling, and it's JACKIEMARTLING.
Every day at 4:20, a very, very off color. You know what's really fun, Andrew, is is these a lot of one-liners. It's simple. When you take a long joke and cram it into 140 characters, it's a great challenge. I really get a kick out of it.
I like how quick it is. I can go in and I can read a bunch of them right now. And anyone who's listening who's not, actually, frankly, if you're easily offended, then go check it out, especially because you need to loosen up. Thank you.
Last thing, if people love jokes and you want to come see a great dirty joke show, all you have to do is email me and you'll get an email full of filthy jokes once or twice a month. And it's jokeland@AOL.com. Everybody yells at me about AOL, so don't you join into the fracas.
I was going to say, you're the last person to still have an AOL account. But it makes it easy to remember, jokeland@AOL.com.
I know I'm long-winded, but I had a great time talking to you.
I love it. I could have you back on every week. I can see why Rick Dees would want you to continue. I could see why Howard Stern had you continue and continue and continue.
Well, I'll tell you the longer story about Rick Dees, and I'll tell you some more crazy stories. I wrote my book, but I haven't published it yet. And also, what is it? KATG, Keith and the Girl, your sister's podcast.
My sister stuff, yeah.
Her podcast. I had so much fun with them too. So I want to throw them a plug.
I heard you on there. It was fantastic.
Kemda.
That's her name.
Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm going to say one more time to close it out, go to jokeland.com. Thank you all for being a part of it. And I would even recommend, I always say, go and email the person who I've talked to and say thank you. Jackie is so freaking accessible. It's surprising. Oh, and there he's got the 922 wine mug up on the screen. All right. Thank you for doing this, Jackie. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone.